The DCF Experience. Hello and welcome to the Design Podcast brought to you by the DCF Experience. My name is David Fleming and we're very lucky today to have a good friend of mine, Paul McGee, on the show. Hi Paul, how are you?
Hi David, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really good. A lot colder and wetter than where you are in Saudi, but it's we're getting by.
Well, it's relative. I mean, it's cold here. It's about, 14, 15 degrees or something.
Is it really?
Yeah, it was today. Yeah, so the less sunny, a bit of sand, obviously, and a bit of dust. Always goes down a storm.
Yeah, I know it well. And look, for all the viewers, I'm obviously very excited because I know you very well. And Paul's currently the VP of Design and UX for Jowi. Now, they are the first truly digital mobile service that was launched in the Middle East. And Paul's an experienced design professional and one of the earliest pioneers of and innovators of digital design with over two decades leading digital experiences. So, I feel very lucky that you decided to join me on my podcast today. So I'm hopeful that the listeners are going to get a good insight into your background and your experience.
Well, thanks. No, thanks for inviting us. It's an interesting medium. So it'll be at least a good chat. For sure.
Well, without sort of trying to corner the phrase, but why don't we start at the beginning? Just give the viewers and listeners a little bit about your background. What got you into design back in the day?
How far would you want me to go back? Do you want to go back to my parents, give them birth, sort of thing?
I don't think we need to go that far.
Okay. Where I come from, Liverpool, as you probably tell from my accent, and there was only a few things I was very good at, and that was art, sport, and joinery, funny enough. My dad was a cabinet maker. My mum was into art, so I sort of had a little bit of it. And when I left school, I didn't really enjoy school too much. So it was a case of picking one of those. And I wasn't good enough at sport to take that up. So it was either art or joinery. Yeah. So I actually started on an apprenticeship, a design apprenticeship, which I suppose luck more than anything else. We started doing posters for bands, screen printing them. And that's for people like, I don't know if you know, I'm going to go back now, for people like Echo and the Bunnymen. Who come from Liverpool, half from Liverpool, and we did a lot of that, and we got a lot of recognition actually for the screen printing. Nice. And that work got me on a design course. Essentially, I just decided that staying in Liverpool and doing what I was doing was not really going to take me anywhere. So I got I was really fortunate again to get a place at one of the best design schools in which was Dunkin' Jordanston. And at the time when we were doing screen printing, the Mac had just been invented, and I got the bug for working on the computer. Wow. And I took that at university to the next level, really, where I was starting to do interactive art. I was starting to do interactive pieces. I won a Royal College of Art award for some interactive piece I'd done, which just at that point I was bitten, and that really got me into it. When I left, I was offered a couple of very good positions, one with Sky TV, doing motion graphics, and one with a small company in Glasgow. Mm. And the small company in Glasgow were actually a print company that were trying to get into interactive art. It was just really starting to take off. In those days, we had things like Director and one of the earliest versions of Flash, and HTML had just started to be developed to a point where you could actually do something with it rather than just it being a communication medium. It was starting to have an interface that you could actually work on. Okay. So at that point, we were working on some interactive pieces for nightclubs and entertainment venues in and around Scotland.
Nice.
And that really gave me the opportunity to do the stuff that I'd investigated at university to take that into a commercial setting. And the work we did for those nightclubs got us global recognition. Actually, we won a lot of awards, and that really set the scene for the rest of my, I suppose, career within experience design. And I mean, I won't go into the details of the projects, but they essentially were probably the most fun days of the role as an experience designer.
Well, if it was anything like me in the late 90s, when the club scene in the UK was very big, then it was a lot of fun.
Superb fun. And we did things for Homelands. I don't even remember the Homelands outdoor music festivals and the nightclub in London. They had one in Leicester Square One. So we did the first inter-club video connectivity, which in those days, it was just leaving a short snippet. a video for a club in Tokyo and Sydney, and those clubs would communicate with each other. So there was a lot of really innovative work that we did. And I worked with some amazing people, and I got the opportunity to work with people like Antti Rom and Elmwood. And we did some pretty amazing work at that time. So,
well, it's a pretty funny story, and probably not one for the podcast, but before I was in recruitment, I was in the music business. And did a lot of work for 10 years with BBC Radio 1 and Ministry of Sound and Head Candy. And I played at the Homeland Festival down near Winchester. I played at home in London with Paul Oakenfold, those guys. So, yeah, that's certainly a conversation for another day.
I think we'll take that one offline, yeah?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. So thinking about, obviously, that's a really good insight in terms of background as to, like, getting into design. But where did you get your influences from? You know, and how did that shape or change over time?
Well, I think my core influence still is typography. I mean, I love typography from early on. I used to love seeing calligraphy. And in fact, my first job pre-computer was hand cutting and hand setting typography. And we used to have, and those, this is when we had Pantone markers, cow gum and scalpels to work with without the Mac. Wow. So the early typographers, you know, I suppose you would probably go all the way to the modernists, you know, the Bauhaus, Joseph Muller Brockman as a modernist. You had, you know, Neville Brody, Eric Spiekerman, Massimo Villiali, who used to do, I suppose, art with typography. And Neville Brody was the probably digital pioneer of typography, where it transitioned from just something on paper to something that was on the screen. And then that got me into, I would say, motion graphics. And that's where I started to look at the people like Saul Bass and Kyle Cooper. I think you might know Kyle Cooper, who did the Seven title sequences. And I was really fortunate. Actually, I met Kyle Cooper and had a good long conversation with him. It was a bit fanny in terms of the way that I was a bit of a starstruck. Yeah, I stalked him a little bit and I was a bit starstruck, but he gave me some good pointers and it sort of influenced me going forward. And I think typography has led me into, you know, communication design, and motion graphics was the big thing. And I think it was motion graphics that really got me into how emotional something could be if you actually communicated it. And typography is about emotion as well, I suppose. And that's where I really got into experiences. I mean, the motion graphics got me into touch and motion and how people interact with screens and how they interact with, and that's how we got into the stuff we did in the nightclubs. Was all about, you know, VJing, and then we had these touch screens when touch screens weren't capacitive, they were just single touch. We developed things on some of the first touch screens on the globe. They were pieces of sticky tape that you put to the front of a normal computer screen to make them touch screen. I mean, it was super fun because we just had fun with music and art, you know, and we created our own music mixes. We had some great programmers as well that meant we could really push it to something that had never been done. You know?
And for me, it's a very interesting point because I don't think emotion has moved too far from the center of either design or any form of communication in today's world. You know, in fact, even probably more so, where everything is so fast now and so online and so quick that it can get it can almost be lost because you need to move so fast in order to keep up, you know. Yeah. And digital has, you know, or online design or digital design has allowed that to happen. But, you know, there is a risk that companies focus less on the emotive part and then just more on just deliver, you know.
I think that's really, and that's one of the cornerstones. I think even now you'll see, you know, like the psychology of user experience. It's all about emotional. I think there's even a phrase, emotional design, you know, and having empathy for the user. But I mean, it's that what sparks the emotion. I think that's where you get the difference between what the UI is, which is one part, the user interface is, which is one part of design. And then you have the whole experience. But, you know, the UI is more about the things that you see, touch and feel. I mean, by feel, it's not just what you put your hand on, it's feel as in how it makes you feel when you engage with it, you know. And that's the psychology of it is where it gets really interesting. I think that's what really quite excites me these days is, you know, what type of emotions can you get? You have micro interactions that can create their own emotions. And I think it was MailChimp that almost launched their whole service on one small micro interaction, which was just once you'd sent an email, it would give you a nice sparky little animation that said congratulations, you've sent your first email. And I think that in terms of taking how motion design can create an emotion and how typography and interfaces can create emotion, but also how that can be engaged on from a business point of view and how a brand communicates from the beginning to the end. So yeah, it's certainly in every aspect of user experience, that emotional part and understanding emotions.
Yeah, no, for sure. Staying on sort of some of the earlier work you did, what give us an idea of some of, say, maybe one or two projects that you worked on when you were younger that you found really fulfilling? And obviously, you mentioned about the nightclub industry, but any other projects that you're working on, you know, at that time that were really, really either exciting or fulfilling for you?
Well, we did. I mean, the good thing about, I suppose, the good thing about those awards and the success of that type of thing, when you're younger, that's really important, obviously. And I think success is obviously a subjective thing. But for me as a young designer, I think for a lot of young designers out there, is that having recognition for the work that you do is great. And, you know, it's superb. But you have to enjoy the job that you're doing to actually create something, I think, new and unique and something engaging. The work that we did for those nightclubs gave us the opportunity then to go into commercial projects with the same approach. You know, they wanted that fun youth aspect of what you were doing in the music industry. They wanted that in a commercial because they needed to communicate their brands. And we worked with the likes of Burger King and JB Scotch. I know it's probably not very popular, but the work we did for them was more about just having a bit of fun, creating games, online gaming and online experiences that really caught and communicated the brand message. And I think that's where a lot of user experience in itself, we used to call them brand experiences. They weren't, it wasn't such a thing as a user experience. It was just communicating the brand with an experience that engaged the user. Yes. So we used to call them brand experiences then. And those were all super fun projects, you know, and the people that I was working with were amazing people. So it just meant that the work was really fun. And then obviously after about 3 years, I set up my own agency, It's Not Rocket Science. And that to me was where the fun really began, because, and it's also where I probably learned my greatest lessons. You know, I think my greatest successes are that I failed a lot. And I think but you have to work without fear. And I think that's what we did with It's Not Rocket Science. When we launched the It's Not Rocket Science, it's all about getting rid of the ego, having a bit of fun and doing something unique with the way that we worked. And I think that's where it started to get from just pure brand experiences into user experiences. I think one of the best projects I think we worked on as a whole team, and I think this is where it became quite collaborative, where technology and marketing and communication for me became, it was obvious that you couldn't do things in isolation. You know, you needed cross-functional teams.
Yes.
And I think that's where it really started to get cool. When we created one of the first online casinos before, you know, Bet360 or any of these were around, they were basically just flash games, but it was a whole flash casino. That was super fun, you know, maybe not very ethical, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, guys, is going back to sort of mid, I did my degree in business and marketing, and a lot of it was about international and experience-based marketing. And then when I was living in Brighton, one of the first jobs I had as a consultant was to do experiential marketing for Bacardi Brown-Forman. This is when I was working in the music business, but they wanted to tap into music and experiences at the same time. So this was this is in the mid to late 90s when they had Bacardi Breezer, when that came out, Smirnoff Ice came out. So they were looking at how people experience drinking with music, but more than that, they were looking at it from what did they do from where they first thought about going to an event, and the experience from the point of sale all the way to reaching the event. And then when you're at the event, are all your emotions and the different touch points that you feel and you want to experience when you go to an event fulfilled? You know, and I guess now everybody just sort of take it for granted that you go there and everything you need is at your disposal, right? Everything. But back then, it wasn't, you didn't have the technology to support doing all the things that you can do now. And they were really a huge pioneer. And that's where the Bacardi Rum Bar was formed from. So now all of the big festivals around the world, you'll always have a Bacardi bar or a Vivid bar or some sort of experiential bar. Havana have now got the same. All of the big brands have got all of this experiential theme to them because it's all about emotion. And for me, it's like quite ironic now that I have my own business and I'm tapping into a lot of people that I was either involved with or I was working in when I didn't even realize it. This was 20 years ago, you know, 18, 20 years ago. So, and that leads me on really quite nicely to How do you think the user experience, UX, has evolved over time, and where do you think it fits now into the design sphere?
Well, I mean, obviously, user experience is more than just design. I think that's what's really interesting about it. It encompasses so many disciplines, and people come into user experience from so many different areas. You know, you have psychology, you have research and analysis, you have statistical data, you have quantitative and qualitative data that feeds into the experience. Whereas in the old days, you just created the experience and you enjoyed watching people enjoy it. You did it almost selfishly and introvertedly, you know, rather than... Now it's about ensuring that you've got data to prove it's successful or it's not successful. Is it working? Is it not working? And you can look at all of that. And you also, you have the teams are more diverse. You know, the people that you work with are more diverse. And I think that's what makes it really interesting. I think user experience, and I think it was Don Norman was the guy that first coined it, the user experience. But it's about the process from the beginning to the end. And, you know, within that process, it's how a user engages with you as a product or a service from the beginning to the end. And it's those steps within that. I touch so many areas. You have care at the end of the process. At the front end, you have the sales team. Before they even touch your product, you have to be able to sell the product and make that emotional engagement. And it's understanding those processes. And I think what's beautiful about it now, and I think I see it a lot actually with a lot of consultancies, there's selling design thinking. In the old days, design thinking was how you worked. You didn't think it was actually something that corporations needed to incorporate into their business processes. And now what businesses are starting to realize that design thinking in itself, which is the process of defining a problem, coming up with a solution based on a series of processes and a series of stages, if you like, and how a customer or a user would go through those processes and basing it on a customer first approach, which is, you know, ask what the user is going to do and then come up with a solution. That type of a thing has now become more preeminent, which makes it brilliant for designers because that's how they define. They create a brief, they define the problem, they go through a series of steps, and that I think empowers them in a lot of ways, especially in a commercial space. And I think that that's become quite evident with a lot of the larger consultancies and the larger agencies and technology companies buying design agencies to empower them to be able to go in and sell the full service, you know?
No, I 100% agree. Thinking about, because obviously on the show, we've got quite a lot of listeners from a variety of different experience levels, you know, CPOs all the way down to junior UX UI candidates looking to get into the industry. So for me, I'd like to move it to sort of tap into your knowledge, if you like, to focus on more so the either junior or mid-level of the market. What recommendations would you give to junior UX or UI candidates looking to get into the industry now, based on the fact that you entered it at a very different time and you've been through the evolution to where we are now? So, you know, I know that people listening to this would probably find your experience on how to get into it very valuable. So any tips, you know, 2-3 ideas, what would you say to junior guys looking to get into the industry?
So I suppose it depends in which area they're coming into the industry. I mean, learn your craft, work super hard, obviously. I mean, where I come from a working class background, it's my dad always gave me a few real good lessons about the only thing you can do. It's great to be think you're naturally skilled, which is some people are, and I think that might be the case. But if you're going to be successful, you have to work hard, you have to be honest, you have to be honest with both the people you're going to when you're doing an interview, but also with yourself. You know, what are your strengths, what are your skills? Focus on them. Don't try and be a jack of all trades. Focus on what you're really good at, because they're the bits that you'll enjoy as well as you go forward. Don't try and do something you don't enjoy. You know, if it's something you don't enjoy, you're not going to do it to the best of your ability. And I think, stick with your process, you know, make a process, make sure that you stick to it, whether it's going through your normal natural thought processes, your presentation skills, make sure your presentation skills are there, make sure you're logical, but always try and be yourself, because that way you'll be original. And I think originality is one of the areas I think is that I see more so now with things becoming so monopolized in the design industry, people using Behance and all of these tools to just take ideas and duplicate them. I've seen a lot of portfolios of young designers coming through and just show me something that I've seen on Behance, and even large consultancies showing us work that just looks like a dashboard off the off one of these template sites. And I think that's the difficult thing. You have to show there was a thought process and a rationale to the work that you've done. And at the end of it, you have to show the results of the work that you've done, or at least the process that you went to get to that end result, and what was your aims for that project.
I think that there's a lot of really good lessons in there, but the one that I would pick out is that, you know, what you don't have for in knowledge and skill, you'll always make up for in hard work. Definitely. You know, and it doesn't matter what industry you're in. You know, the person that usually works smart but works hard would always beat the person that doesn't. And it doesn't matter whether you have the same education or same skill set or same talent. You know, you just learn by design, right? You learn by definition. You learn by doing it more. It's the same with everything. And you mentioned a really good point there about portfolios, because, you know, with the way that technology has evolved over the last, I think probably more so the last 5 years, but definitely since before that, but everything now is just buy off the shelf. You know, you can literally just, you know, WordPress a website through Wix and it's done. You can just copy and paste someone else's work, put it into the same format and it's done.
Exactly.
All the CRMs I look at for recruitment will look the same. Same dashboards, same circles, same everything, right? So it's as if somebody just made it up and then everybody's copied it. And I think that works.
If I see another pill and gradient app design, I'm going to strangle someone.
Well, look, I was talking to a client the other day and he said, look, I need someone that's really strong in UI and visual, you know, senior, so principal or lead position. But I don't want them to have just done marketing services apps. I need this person to have really done some technical, either operating system work or had some really good conceptual ideas around how to create something truly stunning. And I think for me, it comes back to that idea of a concept rather than I'm just transacting. And I think if you're talking to an artist, they'll always put the concept at the beginning. And if you're talking to somebody that's just transacting, then they'll just be making it look good and coloring it in nicely. You know, I know that's a very broad brush, but for me, there is a very big difference when I'm talking to people who are really interested in the art and the design and the concept versus those that are not. Definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, the days of the superhero agencies, the Designers Republic and these agencies that lived on just the aesthetic. I mean, I love their work. There was a background to the Japanese influence, etc. But the fact that you can tell straight away if someone presents you a piece and it hasn't got a background to it, i.e. I've just done it because I like the look of it, rather than I've just done it because the brand had this as part of their approach. There was this sort of brief that required us to meet this target audience. And there needs to be a rationale. And if there's a rationale, the end result is always better and more creative, rather than just saying, I did it because I like David Carson and the grungy look, or I like this piece that I'd seen here. And I think you see it a lot as well with these animated interfaces. When you actually analyze them, they're unusable, a lot of them, in terms of the way they actually function. It looks pretty when you put it up on Dribbble and it looks great, but then you actually see it and you put it in practice and you wouldn't be able to navigate from A to B or A to Z, you know? So I think there's a lot of that lack of thought. And it's not just a thought about how something looks, it's a thought about the process someone has to go to interact with it. And I see that from many agencies. They think, oh, I'll put it here, but then not realizing that, you know, a thumb to interact with a phone, it means your thumb has to go across the screen, or the brand actually doesn't represent the brand in any way, shape or form. It doesn't have the same tone of voice, or it doesn't communicate what that brand is about, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think sort of just going back to a point you made a moment ago, you know, sticking with sort of people who are listening to the show, what do you look for when you look at a portfolio? How does it stand out then now? How does...
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I've been disappointed with the last few that I try to think back to the ones that really struck me. And I have seen one or two. Some were beautifully simple. And rather than being, I mean, obviously you get the standard ones that you get in a Word doc format, but you also get someone who will send you something out off the wall, like it'll be a video or an interactive piece with a link to a website that's just a very beautiful interactive. You know, and that's the challenge again with understanding what you're putting up. When everything you do as a experience designer, and me as an employer, I suppose, is that the way you present yourself is how I would see you would present my clients, or how you would present the work that you do. So, I mean, that's super important. I had a couple of really unusual ones that done this completely off the wall interface for their own CV, you know, and a CV was a walkthrough, if you like, and it was a bit experiential and some of it was there, but it expressed who they were and it expressed what they wanted to talk about. And I quite enjoyed the fact that it was different. And I think it made me stand up and look. It didn't necessarily mean it was completely 100% accurate, and I needed to see the fact that they had a MBA but the fact that they'd done something completely different off the wall and not like a Wix website or a WordPress template or the standard, I did this photograph and that. But also, you know, I think there's the same thing with the way that you communicate. You have to have clarity. Your message has to be clear. So it has to be simple. Don't overcomplicate the portfolio. Don't overcomplicate the message that you're trying to communicate. And then ultimately it comes down to personality and meeting the person and getting their thought process and getting a deeper dive into those projects. And don't show too many projects. Show the work that's been well thought out, that's got probably depth and breadth.
Yeah.
Like a full project from beginning to end, but it shows the brief, the thinking, the results, and it shows that process. And again, originality is the end of the day, and you know, showing who you are as a person in that way.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And I'm seeing sort of, especially over the last year or so, 2 years, the word product is being used more and more now next to design. So do you have a view on the difference between sort of product design and visual design, or product design and UX design? And are you seeing that in the work that's being presented to you and or people you know from the industry?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when I was younger, like I said, my dad was a cabinet maker, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be, and I was almost a joiner. So it was like, oh, I'll do product design because I'm good at design, I'm good at art, and I'll do product design. In those days, product design was, you know, it's Jonathan Ive, you know, it's developing something you actually pick up and use and utensils and physical objects. Whereas now product design has been used to talk about the design of the products that we use in a digital sense, you know, product. And from front to end, really, I think all of these phrases, I remember when we had problems with the word graphic designer, you know, they changed the terminology so often, but I think the difference between a product designer and a UX designer, I'm not 100% sure. It'd be a really good dialogue to have a discussion about it and find out. But I mean, ultimately, I think they are pretty much the same. But the way I would probably define a product designer, that they would probably go heavier into the back-end technologies and how they interlink. They would understand the back-end technologies a lot more, rather than just worrying about the experience from the front-end and the customer experience point of view. They would also think about the customer experience and how that is integrated and how best to deliver it with technology. I think that would be my feelings on it, is that it's more of a technical understanding of how to deliver the product itself. It's not just about the service. You know, what's the service from the beginning to the end? It's about the physical product and how we're going to create that product based on the experience. That would be my rationale for it, I suppose.
Yeah, no, and it's not everywhere at the moment, but what I'm seeing is a lot of people who are becoming chief product officers or product directors have not necessarily come from a UX or a UI background, and some of them haven't even come from a design background.
Or
they're coming from a product management perspective where, depending on the sector, whether it's telecoms or finance or whatever, then they've taken a product from, you know, concept to, you know, cradle to grave, if you like, concept to delivery, and therefore they understand what it takes to be a successful launch. And then if you're at that level, then you would have a team around you to do the other parts of the job.
We used to call it PMO.
That phrase is for everybody to just get together and have a role in a project, right?
Exactly. It's like, I'll organize it and get everyone else to do it. You know, it's like, I mean, that's where it becomes quite difficult and shady. I mean, design as a phrase on its own is very specific, and it's about understanding processes and getting a brief and being creative about a solution. I think design in itself is wider, but once you put product in it, you know, your product manager is one thing, but a product designer, that's completely something different. I think even I've had candidates come as product, they called themselves product designers, and really I would have called them a front-end developer, in the old days. Called them a back-end engineer, you know, and they've decided they've done a course on Agile, and then now they can put design on the end.
Yeah.
I don't mean to as throwaway. That sounds quite throwaway, I suppose. But there is a need to understand the wider process. I think if you're going to tag design onto product, the word, then you need to really have had some sort of grounding and skill, or at least worked extensively within a design environment to put those two words together, I think.
Yeah, no, agreed. And what's your view on how, you know, the most effective way for UX and UI to work together in harmony?
Well, UI is part of UX, I suppose. Ultimately, like I sort of said at the beginning, UI is the bit that people touch and see and feel, and UX is the all-encompassing process of designing the product or service. So, you know, you've got to take the design thinking part, design the process, and then within that there will be an interface that the customer sees and touches. They don't fight each other, I don't think. The thing is, user experience doesn't necessarily need to have an interface. You know, we're now going into a time when we're going into the interfaceless world of experience, you know, with voice and other technologies. And I think at that point, they need an experienced designer that needs to understand what's the process and how we need to communicate and what's the tone of voice. I mean, you know, if you ask the relevant questions, things with bots, even with bots, you need the same sort of process. But you just need, it's like being an information architect. In the old days, we would have called them information architects, and they would find how a product would be presented to the customer. It's a series of steps and processes. And I think now that is where they're becoming blurred. You know, a lot of people mix up UI and UX, but really they're embedded together, essentially. I mean, UX is the wider phrase, or all-encompassing phrase, if you like, for a lot of different disciplines. And within that, you have the user interface. And you might, for a lot of projects, you might not need the interface. That's what I would say.
Okay, interesting. Okay, I want to change direction slightly, because I want to make sure that for the listeners, we've got the opportunity for everyone, both junior and senior. So I want to focus slightly more on the senior end of the market now. So, you know, obviously you've evolved from design through your own business and then moved up into a leadership position with obviously a major company, Jowi. Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to senior hand practitioners who may want to move to be a design leader and move away from being, you know, either a principal or a lead and get into the management side? So, you know, we don't need sort of chapter and verse, but you know, would you have a couple of tips, two or three ideas? How did you make the move? And then what advice would you give to somebody else who maybe wants to make the move?
Well, I suppose brush up on your PowerPoint skills. I suppose letting go is one part, and understanding the wider business. You know, as when you're a design leader, I suppose the difference there is that you are involved more closely with the team or the wider team. You're creating the team, you're managing the team. Once you become one level up, it's really about defining what the business is going to do and how best to communicate that business, and then working the team around those requirements. And it's also about strategy and understanding trends and what's best for the business side. And then you have to also communicate that to the wider audience, and you have to be able to work with the executive teams. And I think a lot of people, there's certain areas that just transition very easy, and there's some areas that can be very difficult to transition. I was very fortunate that I had a lot of lessons early on hard-learned lessons that gave me the ability to communicate in a different way with certain executives, because, you know, some people have different approaches, and it's understanding those those different personalities and being able to get them to work together in the best way and getting the best out of people based on that. So I suppose it's all about the more business related approach to what you're doing, rather than focusing on just the experience itself. Although at the end of the day, that is what will benefit the business, is the experience, you know, from start to finish. And I think that's where it's great that design leaders become executives, you know, and I think it means in a wider, and that's why, like I said earlier, is companies like Accenture and IBM, et cetera, those companies are starting to see the benefit of having the link between business and experience, you know, yes. analytics, business experience, business analysis, psychology, all of these areas that make a company tick. They can they sell that now. That's their bread and butter because that's what you need. And I think ultimately from a I think the hardest part to do is to let go of the day-to-day part that you would normally do and
yeah.
go into the area of strategy and understanding and management, which is the business management rather than the actual design part. And that, as I suppose if you come from a design background, it becomes even more difficult because really you've got to trust and really trust and have great people around you to trust to yeah. do work as you would want it to be done. And ultimately, yeah. that's where process comes into play, having the right processes and building the right processes and then giving that to the people to implement means if you've done those things right, you're going to have the right results, or at least the result you hope, which is a great product for the end user, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I find that talking to a lot of senior people like I do, sometimes my advice is always, if you don't necessarily want to make the move, then don't. And it comes back to what you said earlier, for someone in the junior level, find something that you love to do and then stick with it.
Yeah.
And often I find that people are trying to move in a direction that they don't even, and they don't even know why, when really you'd be more than happy being the lead or the most senior person responsible for design, but without all of the other business headache.
That leads on quite nicely to another area, which I suppose is part of that. When you go one level up, is seeing, I mean, you learn how certain people have certain skills. You can see where they're best suited, and you can, I wouldn't say push, but you would edge or nudge someone in that direction. You can give them training in the direction that you feel they would be brilliant at and that they obviously have a passion for. And I think I missed one thing that was that you have to have in this industry. And if you're not going to succeed, and that's passion. You know, if you don't have empathy and you're not willing to let go of your ego and you don't have that passion for the job, go and do something different.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And often I'm advising senior people, you know, along all we're talking, it's not even advising, it's just understanding why they even want to make the move into a more senior role when they spend half an hour, 45 minutes talking to me about how much they love conceptual design. And then I say, well, you do know that when you're not doing that, you're going to be not doing it. You know, when you move up to another more senior role, that won't be part of your role, you know, yeah. as much, right? You'll be more marketing, business strategy, managing stakeholders, you know, collaborative approach, which is all really good stuff, but it's not, you still have to move away from being at the heart of whatever's being designed.
Yeah, and you have to care about every aspect of the business. It's not just about the design part. It's about how well our support unit is working, how well the sales team are doing their job, and then also, you know, how well the design is fitting for the design team, for the sales team or the marketing team, or, you know, is that bit of communication actually unified with the whole brand and the business in itself, and making sure that the tone of voice is communicated by the care agents in the call centers. I mean, it's literally caring about the wider business, not just that one corner of the office, you know. And I think that's what excites me, is the fact that it's actually, you can get involved with people from different areas of the business, and you can create cross-functional teams, which in a lot of industries, especially in the industry I'm in right now, was alien to them. You know, telecommunications work in silos. They're not used to working with having technology sitting next to design and marketing and communication and care all in the same team.
Yeah,
you know, that's one thing we've been very fortunate. We set up as a separate entity within Jowie, was having that cross-functional, small open space office. I think you came to our office
many times.
We deliberately made it open plan. Works and doesn't work in some cases if you want peace and quiet, but in other areas where you need to just sit with a bunch of people in the corner and brainstorm something or solve a problem, it's there and done, and it's open, and so it's out there. You know, you're not sitting in one end of the office making a phone call and waiting for someone else to do something. It's working same way we did when we were an agency, or you're in the agency world, but in a commercial environment, you know?
Yeah, it's very true, very true. And what about as a leader, you know, and obviously I don't want any sort of, you don't need to get into any sort of trade secrets, but how do you, at a sort of at the top level, how do you quantify your work in design? Where does, you know, how do you present the ROI? Because it's not sales, right? So it's well, closer to marketing than it is sales, right?
Sales is part of it. Obviously, at one point, there's a certain element of that. But from our side, I mean, we have NPS and CSAT, which is one measure, which is, you know, if people are promoting their product. And what we found actually in our current area is that we do a thing called member gets member. And that is our biggest selling tool. We don't, when you get to a point where your brand is selling itself or your customers are selling your product, then you know that you're hitting the right mark, or you're being successful at some point or in some areas. But also, you know, you have quantitative and qualitative data. I mean, the beauty of experience is that you can get a bunch of people into the office and do proper testing before you actually launch anything. And we do testing in the office. We have a usability lab, which is one of the first in the Middle East, in the office, where we bring users in to test the product. We test the product before we launch it. We do wireframing and prototype, and we test in the office with staff, and we then export that to a wider audience. We have beta testers. We have an idea lab that all our customers then invest time and effort to put their ideas up for us to then develop our product, and we reward our customers based on those ideas. And I think that's really important. If you've got, I mean, the whole point of our business proposition, that was co-created with our users, and that was again something that was very alien to the, I suppose, the telecommunications industries. They didn't realize that, and I think they dropped the ball, telecommunications, to be honest, in that they have the closest connection with the widest possible audience because everyone has a mobile phone, but they have the least emotional connection with that user. It's the user who has that mobile phone doesn't care that they've got
very true
them inside the phone, or
so true, yeah,
or they care whether it's Google or iOS or whether it's Facebook or WhatsApp or Snapchat. They don't care about the other area, the person that's providing them with the data that they're using, you know.
No, that's very true. And I think that's where, you know, obviously we could talk for hours about this, but I think that's where Apple have done so well, because Apple has more of an emotive feel to it. People who are with Apple typically have more than one Apple device or something that they use Apple for. And I think that you will, once you're with them, you tend to stay with them. And I've certainly evolved with them over time. And now I used to have PC. Now I don't have anything, you know, other than Microsoft Office on my Mac, but I have a Mac, I have an iPad, I have a phone, you know, so I'm always looking to, and it's very much about the Apple brand. But apart from that, you know, you wouldn't know whether it was Vodafone or Orange or EE or Saudi Telecom or Do or whoever, right? Or Telefonica or O2. Nobody really knows, do they? Even though they've got all of the best data you could possibly imagine in order to produce the results that you want.
And I suppose it's the same thing when you open a computer now, or you open your laptop or your phone or your iPad, you expect to have instant internet. You don't expect to have to wait. It's the same when you engage with an interface. You don't expect something to stutter or splutter or fail. And I think that's one area Apple got right. You know, their computers don't crash very often. The tablets don't. I'm sitting here in front of an Apple device or two, but I also have an Android, and I use my Android. I don't use an Apple phone. And that's specifically, there's a lot of things Apple are getting wrong right now. And I mean, a longer philosophical conversation about Apple, but ultimately there's a lot of things they're getting wrong. One is pricing, pricing themselves out the market, but it's really good competitors coming in. But the other is their whole cloud service and how they lock people into their ecosystem and how they've tried to close it up. And it's great for security in some ways, but that closure means that you also isolate a wider audience. And it also means if you're not going to integrate with other services and products, I think things are going to move away. And if Apple don't decide to do something about it, I think but I could go on about that for a long time because I've got my own things on it. I hate the whole iCloud. You've not got storage space on your device, and then you get stuck trying to, you don't want to, but it comes up every single time. There's no way of canceling it. And then, you know, there's a bunch of other things I don't like, but hey.
No, I know what you mean. And for me, it's more about just they do get you in with the emotive side, though, the brand bit, and that's what they're really good at. But I know what you mean. I mean, I'm with you on the way that it looks and feels. There are other products that are far better that, you know, that if they learned from them, they would probably do much better. I mean, they do more than good enough as it is, right? That's the challenge.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that Steve Jobs didn't believe in user testing. He believed what he had was right, and that was his approach, and that was the way it was going to be. Because user testing and relying too much on data meant that you weren't going to be innovative, you know. And I think that's maybe the double-edged sword of relying on user data and feedback, is that maybe we put so much in data analysis that we don't actually create something new and different, because the user generally will feedback on something they are used to rather than what it's, you know, they only can react to what's there in front of them. They can't create something new and different.
Yeah, very true.
Other philosophical conversation that, you know, we could.
I'll get you back on the show in a couple of months and we'll get into that. A whole show about Apple. Well, look, I want to finish on a couple of things because, you know, again, the whole point of these podcasts is to not only get into the design space and speak to thought leaders like yourself, but it's also a way for me to give back to the industry and also for yourself, because you have such a wide level of experience. So the last two things I want to finish with, I guess, first one, you know, what would you say has been the biggest learning of your career? And then the second one would be, you know, and I know we sort of touched on this earlier, but I want to really drill down into just one area. What would be the single bit of advice you'd give for a new, you know, UX, UI candidate to get ahead? So those would be the two questions to finish.
So what was the first one again?
What would you say is your biggest learning that you've had over your career?
Failing is okay. In fact, it's the best thing you can do. It's the biggest lessons I learned were when I failed. And I mean, having your own agency is great. We did a lot of brilliant stuff, but we failed as probably more than we succeeded. And in that respect, I learned so much more from the failures than I have from the success. And I think that is the thing. Don't be scared of failure. It's the thing that you can take with you and you'll learn more from it. It's failure in a lot of ways, you know, understanding people, not communicating the right way, doing a product in the wrong way, maybe going too quick, too slow. You know, there's lots of lessons learned and different ways that you produce products and develop products. And I think it's those failures that I've probably gained as much, but also, you know, be a sponge. You know, you're privileged in this industry. I think we are privileged, and I've been privileged to have been in it, you know, is that it's such a, every day you open a book or you read a blog or you, you know, listen to a podcast and you learn something new from someone new who has a different approach, and it just be a sponge and listen and absorb. And, you know, that would be my single piece, I would say.
Okay. So sort of killed two birds with one stone there for sure.
Oh, did I?
The last bit was, what would be your single bit of advice you'd give for a new UX or UI candidate who wants to get ahead?
Ah, yeah. So that's the sponge bit. Yeah, I suppose be a sponge, drop the ego, and, you know, work with passion. That's not a single piece, is it? That's quite a few.
No, but anyway. I think they all have the same underlying message, and that came from the conversation you had earlier when you first got into it, right? When you first get into design or you first get into a career, I think what I'm seeing now, especially from a recruitment point of view, is people are wanting things really quickly, but the world isn't moving at the same speed as that they want to their careers to develop.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, user experience encompasses a lot of different areas that you can get into. So, I mean, it might be that you come into user experience from one discipline, and just by being passionate about it, you might find a different area of that discipline. It might be the psychology part. It might be the design thinking part. You might have come from a technology background, but you're an amazing process person. You're good with analytics and that understanding. Or you might get into artificial intelligence and machine learning and, you know, start becoming an app developer. I mean, it's just a vast industry that covers so many areas that really you might become a great strategist, you know, and that's what I would say, is just be open and learn. And that's, you know, don't ever stop learning. I mean, I never stop learning, and still to this day. And I suppose any design leader will say the same thing, is, you know, there's a billion and one books I haven't read, and there's a billion and one podcasts and vloggers that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
And so I still go back to my old books. And I think that was one thing when we spoke last, and I thought, you know, I even went back to the old thesis to start thinking about the things that I'd seen at
Bidwell, who
influenced you, you know, and you still, and they still to this day stand at the time because they were original and different, and they were honest, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that I'm talking about now, I didn't think I'd ever use when I, because I, you know, naturally didn't go into design or art because I was in music. But now when I look back to the marketing that I did and then the roles that I had and how they're now still relevant now, it's crazy because that was 20 years ago. But I think that the single thing for me is always around finding something you really like or really love, and then spending a lot of time doing it, because that will always give you more satisfaction than looking for something you think other people have because you want it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, when you're young, it's the time to make the mistakes.
Yeah. And it's funny, I actually had a conversation with somebody earlier, and we, well, I don't know why we were talking about the past, but she, you know, she said, you know, when you're having fun, you're not, you don't look for anything else.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I often talk to my wife and friends about what we did in the 90s and the 2000s. And I think that it's very easy to say, oh, maybe I could have done this when I was done this or gone in this direction or that. But I think when you're enjoying yourself, you're never looking for a different direction. You only start to look for a different direction when you're not loving what you're doing. So if you're fortunate enough to find something that you love, doesn't matter what it is, stick at it for as long as it, you don't love it anymore, then find something else, because that will always get you further in that one thing that than trying to do five things.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I've got kids now, and I've always tried to say to them, you know, ultimately, don't think that what you're doing now is going to be the thing you do later. Don't pigeonhole yourself. But like I say, you know, just love whatever you're something, if you're passionate about it, go for it. You know, don't have any fear, go for it, trust it, and you know, don't think that you're not good enough or you're never going to achieve it. Just go for it. That's
Agreed. Look, mate, it's been amazing having you on. It's been a pleasure. There's some really valuable tips there. You know, for all the people that are listening to this, if you want any more information from Paul or any tips, then you can obviously leave a voice message on my app. But for now, I'm going to sign off. I'm going to let you get back to your evening. I've certainly got an evening to get to with the family.
Liverpool to watch. So
It's on later. Hopefully, they'll go 5 points clear again at the top of the table.
Yeah, well, that's just lost you about 10 billion viewers. There you go.
All right, good man. Listen, Paul, stay in touch. And once this is ready, I'll send you a message and we'll get it out onto the podcast, and I'll let you know when it's all finished.
Excellent. Cheers, good David.
Man. Yeah, talk good again. Time. Yeah, cheers, mate. Bye for now.